and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon at Dave's Gone By UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, my friends. Shalom, my musical friends and listeners. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am so delighted to be talking music and cabaret and nightclubs with a very special person, one of the absolute all-time bests in the field. In fact, the New York Times has called this man the Crown Prince of New York Cabaret. And I'm called the Clown Prince of my synagogue, so that's a difference right there. This is the man, let me tell you, who reopened the Algonquin Oak Room to cabaret after many years. And he's played at the Rainbow Room and in Spoleto, in Hong Kong, in Perth, in Brazil. Oddly enough, he's never played Greeley, Colorado, but we hope to change that someday. He has a dapper, swelligant persona, kind of like Stan Laurel almost in a tux, a 1992 Mac Award winner. He was on Broadway in Present Laughter many years ago. The San Francisco Chronicle wrote about Steve Ross. Attending his performance is like opening a treasure chest of great, often rare songs. No one performing today is his equal. And you can see him on October 23rd at Birdland in New York playing the songs of Irving Berlin. Please welcome to the neighborhood our new friend, Steve Ross. Shalom, Steve.
Shalom to you, Saul. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, good. Now, first of all, what is your Hebrew name?
My Hebrew name would be Steve Ben Clifford.
I like that. So, I sometimes talk a little bit religiously. Were you raised religiously at all, or atheistic, or polytheistic?
I was raised as a Roman Catholic, and I'm still recovering. I had a Christian background, but I've always been very, and I remain to this day, very curious about other people's journeys toward God, or who they perceive as God, or the spiritual world. And sometimes that even affects my art, I think. But I've tried to be what I like in people. There are two traits that I like, and I think you already have them from only knowing you for 30 seconds.
What would those be? Uh-oh, what are they?
The two traits are curiosity.
Okay.
Enthusiasm.
Oh, yeah, that's me. I thought you were going to say kindness and decency, which absolutely not.
I'm sure you're a great humanitarian, but as far as the traits of people that I like to spend time with, curiosity, you can't infuse that. You either have that or you don't. And to be enthusiastic about anything, collecting guppies, stamps, friends, writing music, it is a great gift that you have, if you have that, I believe, don't you?
I do indeed, and the gift of music to you apparently stemmed from your mamala, playing at the piano or something? How did that...
At the piano, absolutely. My father listening on Saturday afternoons to the opera while he worked, but my mother was a pianist, and she gave me this great gift, and I was able to achieve a certain amount of in my career, and to show her. As a matter of fact, I haven't done it much, but I did play with the symphony orchestra once, and to me that represented quite an achievement, and she was able to be there, and I felt really that I had made her proud.
Oh, that's so your parents lived for a good period of time into your success.
Yeah, they did. This was probably, she was in her 60s or something when she heard me do this concert with the Roanoke Symphony, in fact, it was. It was a Cole Porter orchestration, but I had two wonderful Jewish boys orchestrated this. You may know of the great vaudevillian who recently passed, Feivish Finkel.
Oh, he was on my program. I talked to him. What a wonderful man. Oh, my God.
As supreme. He was the best man in the world, and he has two extremely talented sons.
Ian and who's the other one?
Ian and Elliot.
Elliot Finkel. Well, one of them was also on this program because he's a writer. I think it was Ian. He writes mystery novels and things.
And one of the best xylophone players in the world, so self-styled, and he probably is. And Elliot is a brilliant pianist and orchestrator. So I chose them, and I engaged them to do these symphonic arrangements, and they're just marvelous. So I feel that I'm basically Jewish. I really have to...
Oh, that's wonderful. That's terrible because your penis just shrank 3 inches. But, you know...
No. Listen, my name, as you know, Saul, was an was often a name change in the 40s. My grandfather was kind of in the movie business, and his name was Harry. Harry Ross. Harry, so sounds like it could have been Harry Roth.
No kidding.
Harry Rothman. But it was Harry Ross. And since he was in the movie business, so I always thought basically I was a changeling and I was basically Jewish. So
it could, I mean, honestly, when your parents, where were they, what was the background? I know you were raised from a Catholic.
My father was vaguely a Christian, and my mother was a very good Catholic lady. She had her five children, of whom I was the second. And
but country-wise, the origin?
Oh, background is, I wish there were, in fact, a little bit of Mediterranean in me. Although I haven't done the DNA test, it was supposed to, it's Irish, Irish, Welsh, Scottish, and English. You know, very, very nice.
Well, even anyway, Harry Ross.
I always wanted there to be a little Italian, a little Jewish, a little Gypsy. That I would have been a little bolder in my life. But these are all conjectures. The main thing is that I love music, and so many people have written it, and I'm happy to continue to play it.
When did you start taking actual piano lessons?
I think it was with Mrs. Mahoney. Do you remember her?
I'm afraid not. No. I knew a Mrs. Mahonowitz, but it was another side of town, yeah.
If you were in the small town of Millbrook, New York,
oh.
In 19, I want to say 1945. See, I started when I was about 7 years old, I think. And we went on from there. I had a lot of different teachers along the way for everything, as we travel. But she was my first piano teacher, and she was a lovely lady. Then I studied with one of the nuns who was at the Catholic school I was attending. And my mother, we lived about an hour, maybe an hour and a half outside of New York City, and my father worked in the city. So I remember distinctly overhearing her call Juilliard and saying, look, I've got a talented son. Do you have any master students or who could teach him? She wasn't enrolling me in the school, but she thought it might be a graduate student. And I went down and studied with him for a while. She could never remember his name. He probably ended up being, a world-famous pianist. But my mother took my music very seriously. And as a matter of fact, when I didn't practice 1 year, she stopped my lessons. But then I got back into her good graces.
I was going to ask that, because even as a child, and you loved music and you loved the piano, took it seriously. But still, you're a kid. You got to sit down 45 minutes to an hour and a half every day. Other kids are out there playing and hitting each other with sticks.
I was never a sportsman, but I somehow was indolent about the whole thing. And she said, okay. I mean, there was no... She said, well, since you're not going to practice, well, just do other things. But I kind of missed it, and we were moving, so she let me play it again. Because she played by ear, and see, that's always the easiest thing.
Now, playing with your fingers is much easier than the ear.
No,
it's the head.
Physically, it's your ear. But, so she, and I thought that was the way people played, so I played by ear a little high school things, and I picked up songs. And I knew that I was too dedicated to instant gratification to practice for the 7 or 8 hours requisite to being a concert pianist. So I never got far in the classical world. But I left college because I was already playing in a saloon. And that's how it started all those years ago. And I never looked back.
I just, you look and sound so elegant in that old-fashioned style. That's two things I can't picture you doing. Playing in a real saloon as opposed to a nightclub.
Well, we all started in saloons. We didn't start in fancy nightclubs. I was at Georgetown University or Catholic University, and I wanted a job, and the thing I knew how to do was to play the piano, and there was a ragtime was kind of around in that first go-round in the 60s. There was a ragtime piano bar near me, and I love ragtime, so I got my little boater hat and the garters on my striped shirt and started playing ragtime, and that was one of my very first jobs, and I loved it. But I love being with the people, I love the attention, and I love playing. So that was kind of what took me on the path.
Well, I mean, I believe it now. I can sort of see it now. But the other thing is, I cannot picture you in the military.
I was I was in the Army. I was drafted right out of that ragtime job, as a matter of fact, in 1961. And this was a draft, so I went. And I was very lucky because the horrors of Vietnam were yet to unfold. And I got a job in a special services thing where I was in a hospital and we were trying to put on shows, and so I was the piano player in the shows. And so it was a kind of an easy little 2 years for me, and I got out.
And wait, where was it? Where were you stationed?
I was in Seattle, Washington.
Oh, so you didn't even leave American soil. You were fine.
Never did. Both of my brothers were in the Marines, and both of them fought in Vietnam. But I kind of lucked out with that one.
Well, how were they doing? Did they get out of Vietnam, and were they okay?
One of my brothers has passed away, but as perhaps you have experienced, the other one never talks about it. Hmm. And I've known this with many vets. They just don't wish to talk about it because it was so awful or whatever it was. It was not a memory that they want to go over. Although they're the old thing of when you talk to an old soldier, you know, he wants to relive the battles and all that. But I've never been interested in that. I mean, he's never talked about it particularly, so I don't talk about it myself.
Oh, let me tell you, a couple of days ago, I went to a diner. I had a terrible breakfast. Can't discuss it. Probably not for weeks.
But you were traumatized by those scrambled eggs.
Oh, they were rubbery. I can't. It's PTSD.
Listen, I don't want to bring up a bad memory. We're having a nice time.
Right.
I understand that.
It's PTSD, if you think about it. I don't even know what that means.
Okay.
I'm sorry. But now, you became known, and you're still really known, basically for Cole Porter and Noel Coward, even though your repertoire goes far beyond that. How did that... Was that just a natural gravitation to that kind of song?
Well, I tell you what, you know, I didn't begin as a singer. I began as a piano player.
Right.
And when I moved to New York, I had sung in public twice or three times. And I used to sing funny little English music hall songs. I never thought I could sing, but I knew I could play the piano. So when I finally, at a much delayed hour, not until 30, I moved to New York, although I lived nearby and visited all the time. And I always tell the story, I was in therapy because something must have been wrong, I don't know what it was. And when I noticed that the therapist was dropping off, I said, this is the time. The writing was on the ceiling, and I got into my car, and I moved to New York City. But when I went to get this job, they said, well, you sing too. I said, I don't sing. They said, do you want the job? We're not going to hire two people. And I said, of course I sing. Of course, I had to learn some songs really quickly and learn how to sing. And many, many teachers, and many years later, I can't imagine performing without singing as well. But when I first sang, I was very attracted to songs that had clever words because I didn't have the big tones that the big singers have. So that was what drew me to Cole Porter because of the great cleverness and sophistication of his lyrics. So I would sing a couple of those songs, and then from then on I went on. But I started off singing kind of funny ditties, and there are so many brilliant ones from the American Songbook, all these different composers, Yip Harburg and Lorenz Hart and Berlin. So then I moved on to ballads when I found out I could hold a note longer than a minute.
Well, this was, a minute, that's a pretty long time.
No, I mean, you know what I mean.
Yeah, but I think you're starting the way Sprechsinging, this kind of talk sing, the Rex Harrison thing, although a little more tuneful than he.
Yes, I always could sing on pitch, but it's just that I, you know, didn't trust my ability, to move an audience with a love song. You know, the most songs in the songbook or in the world songbook, of course, there are songs of protest, songs of activism, but most songs seem to deal with the elusive emotion of romantic love in one way or the other, don't they?
Well, like my personal favorite, Oogie Oogie Oogie, I always,
That's the troubadour's task, is to sing those songs and to put into the songs the emotions that we all feel, but they're not elegantly expressed. So I never thought I could do that, and I used to teach. I still teach. I still work with students. And I was demonstrating a ballad to this student, and he said, oh, you ought to sing that. And I said, oh, no, I don't sing ballads. I just sing funny songs. And at that saloon that I was working at that night. I remember this vividly. I tried to sing this song. And I won't say there was a hushed silence, but I will say that people paid attention. And it was a very heady, life-changing experience for me to realize that I could sing a love song, putting my own feelings into it, and have other people identify it. And I have never looked back from that either.
Actually, one of the difficult things I've always found is if I sing a song that has real emotion in it for me, and that I find very touching and moving stuff, it's hard for me not to give over and cry during the song, which of course kills the song for anybody listening to it. How do you deal with that if you're really emotional about a song already?
Yes, I understand that. There was one marvelous singer, I've forgotten her name, a black lady who used to sing when I first came here, and that was the only person who could cry and sing. As I remember, she walked up to the piano with a box of Kleenex. We knew that she was going to be crying, but somehow it was part of her thing. I like the when I rehearse a song and I really love it, I'm very rarely moved even to the verge of tears. I get it. I like it. When I am on the job and I feel the energy coming back from the audience and I am taking myself and them to an emotional place, that's when I get just to the edge of tears. But I have never cried, because it's that would cut the whole thing off. It would be distracting and the audience couldn't continue on the journey, because they would all of a sudden, what's wrong with him? And you know, so I see what you mean, but tears do not come that readily while I'm performing.
If you get verklempt, it preempts the audience from being verklempt. They say that about actors who, you know, you don't cry on stage, you get to the verge of it, so the audience has the release. It's that kind of a thing.
Yes, that's exactly. Well, I never knew what verklempt really meant. Does that mean emotional?
Well, according to Mike Myers, you get the lump in the throat, you get a little bit of a tearing up.
It's about to have an emotional thing. It's verklempt, yeah.
Right, yeah. It's sort of like a constipation of emotions, if you will.
Well, you're just holding them back.
Exactly.
Got it.
We're talking constipation here with the wonderful Steve Ross.
Thing that I've talked about in previous interviews, I have to say.
Oh, I would hope not. That's why you're talking to me, Rabbi Sal, here on Dave's Gone By. By the way, I should reiterate that you can go see Steve Ross in Come On In Here, an Irving Berlin celebration that he is doing at Birdland on October 23rd. So when did you discover, I guess early on you weren't just doing Cole Porter, you discovered Berlin pretty soon after that.
Yeah, the great songs. I mean, I'm in my 70s now, so the great songs on radio were played, and my mother played them when we had recordings. I can't remember. I tell you, when I started working outside of ragtime, when I went to a regular piano bar job, obviously I had to prepare myself for requests. That was how I made a lot of my income. And I got what they used to call, you may not know of them, they had fake books.
Oh, they still do. It's 100 songs in it that everybody wants to hear.
Indeed, that's right. And they're kind of like this, but this poor guy went up the river for this, because he just took the chorus and the words and he put them. So I used to go, now people have them on iPads, but I would go to the job with these two big books and people would say, can you play, I don't know what, Almost Like Being in Love? And if I didn't know it, I would play it. But then as people asked for things, I would learn them. I tried to learn a song a day. And many of the songs they asked for were Irving Berlin ballads. Mm. I still sing to this day with continuing surprise. Always, all the beautiful waltzes that he wrote, How Deep Is the Ocean in one of the 10 great songs. I have a great respect for him, and I love singing his tunes.
It's just funny that you mentioned that particular one, because the host of this radio program, Dave Lefkowitz, who is Jewish, by the way, he and his wife, the first date that they went to see an off-Broadway production of the Marx Brothers' Coconuts.
I kind of remember that.
And they sang Always, because it was in the movie. It was Berlin did the music for the movie of the Coconuts, and Always was in there, and that became their song for him and his wife. They played it at the wedding and everything.
It never fails to. I'll have to check that. I thought it was withdrawn from the coconuts. But was in the production of the.
When they put it in when they did it, I guess, at Jewish Repertory or wherever the American Jewish Theater did it or something.
You know, it's one of the great stories that they were in Atlantic City at the Ritz Hotel, wherever that is. He and George S. Kaufman, the noted curmudgeon, and Berlin, they were looking for the big ballad for that musical, and he always liked to get immediate approval. So we called him up, middle of the night, woke him up, not at his best, and he said, "They've written this song, I'll Be Loving You Always." He sang it over the phone, and George said, "I think it's a little ambitious. How about I'll Be Loving You Thursday?"
That's classic.
And Kaufman, and he was so incensed that he never had the song on the show, and he gave it to his wife or something. But I guess since it was intended for that, Grace Moore, I think, was the one who meant.
Oh, I don't recall, but
it is a gorgeous, gorgeous song. And of course, the economy of Berlin's vernacular use. There isn't a wasted note or word in that song.
I'm assuming you play it in your current show, an Irving. Come on and hear an Irving Berlin Celebration.
I play a lot, several.
And what else? What else do you play?
I talk to the people about so many different parts of him. Waltzes before then were spirited and they moved quickly, but he was the first one, in my view, to slow that tempo down and to make it a meaningful romantic experience. I'll Be Loving You Always. Remember All Alone. What else do I do? These are the ballads that are quick, but I do, because I love ragtime, I do a lot of his early ragtime songs, which were songs not necessarily in the ragtime syncopation, but they were about ragtime. The famous one that made him world famous and made him very rich was Alexander's Ragtime Band, as you know. And
where Come On and Here comes from, of course.
About a ragtime band, but it wasn't in the ragtime tempo necessarily. But anyway, when was the last time, for example, that you heard, there's a lovely ragtime tune of his that I sing called The Yiddish Eskimo? Do you know that one?
No!
It's all true. Trust me.
The Yiddish Eskimo. I know you're not near the piano or anything, but can you give us a little abyssal?
One of the words is, I'm one of God's frozen people. I mean, I will say no more than that.
No need. Oh, that's so good.
You have to look up the words of that. They're too much. It was for Fanny Bryce, the great comedian, of course.
Oh, okay.
Really adorable. And he had lots of ragtime songs. He was a very, look, he came from nothing. And he was concerned about business. He was very eager to make sure that his songs made money and that he was a businessman. He was a very rich man by the time he was 30 from his work. And what was around, although he came at the end of the ragtime era, everybody wanted to hear ragtime. So he did ragtime songs. There's one other Jewish one that I love.
He was doing Yiddish novelty tunes for a while.
I love that. That's
a bunch of them, yeah. But can I ask you, did you, since you've been in the business, yeah, you 40, 50 years singing and stuff, and he lived to be 100 million, did you ever meet him?
Never did.
Oh, okay.
Never met the man. I know you know the famous story that some of his devotees would meet and sing White Christmas every Christmas Eve outside his townhouse. Have you heard that?
Oh, of course, yeah. There was
when
he was 97 years old, 98, every year they come.
They come at one time. The little old man in the blue bathrobe invited them all in for hot chocolate one time.
Oh.
And, he was reclusive at the end of his life. Maybe he was in pain or maybe he was I have no idea.
But with all the respect, you're old enough to have met and maybe sung for or performed. Did you ever meet Richard Rodgers?
I introduced myself to him when he was staying in the auditorium after a performance of his last show. I remember Mama, I introduced myself and thank him. I'm a huge believer in support and expressing gratitude. It's very, very important for me, and especially to these people who've enriched my lives. He's the only biggie that I knew, help me. Lerner and
Fred.
Burton Lane.
Oh, yeah.
I love Burton Lane. He was a charming guy, and I know his wife to this day. So him I knew. I met Alan J. Lerner once at a benefit, but I've never really played. Oh, yes, there was... No. Uh-huh. I've never really had the honor to play for any of the greats, their tunes. I wish I had.
And you do have an entire album of Stephen Sondheim songs.
Yes, that's true. You're absolutely right. He has heard... Ah, of course. What am I crazy? That album was recorded... was from a live performance I did in England, but the very same show, which I did at the Algonquin when they had a cabaret room there, he did come.
Ooh.
And I was very, very pleased, and he, you know, he's God to everybody. I mean, I must say, I was a bit intimidated, but he had heard me play 30 years ago just at a party, but he was very personable and chatted and came over. I mean, he summoned me to the table, and I said hello, and I met his friend, and it was a great treat. Sondheim is the genius of the place these days. He really is.
Now, I mentioned that you have a Sondheim CD, and then you have a much older CD of you at the Algonquin, and then there's other CDs that have either gone out of print or still a little bit in print. How have you navigated the changes in the way music is disseminated from when you were starting, like the 1960s and 70s,
right,
to now?
I don't know, Saul. I have been somewhat delinquent in getting all of my songs. I mean, people nowadays listen to it either on Spotify, which is the free streaming service, or they go to iTunes and they listen to it or they buy it. So those are the two big ways to listen. And a lot of my stuff is not up on Spotify, and it should be. I don't sell any CDs. I buy them, and I mean, no one buys them, even the Altacacus that I put, don't buy them.
Well, no, but when you go give a concert, don't you come out at the table and do the signy thing afterwards?
But yeah, a couple of people buy them, but not many people buy them. Maybe they buy them to play in their cars, but nowadays, new cars don't even have CD slots anymore. They have things for your iPhone. So to me, the whole thing, I mean, I have participated in the golden age of recording and singing. To be honest with you, not that we're speaking about dire Cassandra-like things, I don't know how long this all will last. I really don't.
This all meaning the recording in this?
Oh, the recording, people will continue to make records, and
yeah,
a small number of people aging rapidly will enjoy listening to them. Younger generations, I don't know whether you have children or grandchildren, but...
I have 22 and a half beautiful... Well, 21 are beautiful. The other one and a half, not so much, but yes.
Are you talking about grandchildren or children?
Both. I forget. I look at them, my eyes aren't so good. If they're very small, I think the grandchildren...
Do you talk to your grandchildren about music and ever? And they have no... I'm not kvetching. There's absolutely no interest. So you can't make somebody interested in what I do. Every now and then, if a grandchild is dragged by a grandparent to one of my shows, they seem to enjoy them, but music is different for them. Everybody has a musical soundtrack, but ours is not theirs.
Now, here's the deal, though. I read somewhere that you don't dislike rock and roll. You actually listen to stuff that isn't Great American Songbook or Musical Theater Songbook. So what might be something surprising that you enjoy listening to?
In a more modern way?
Yeah.
A modern pop sound? Not much.
Oh, I thought you do listen to a little rock and roll. I won't peg you for a Black Sabbath guy, but...
I don't listen to music. The only time I play the piano is when I'm preparing for a show. I enjoy that process. But I don't, in fact, sit around and listen to music. I don't have the classical music station on in the air. I will go to hear somebody's cabaret because I believe that as a kind of a senior member of the community, I have to support them. And I enjoy many, many young artists who sing beautifully. And the cabaret world... there used to be many more standards from the songbook that you would hear in a cabaret performance from a younger cabaret artist, but not so much anymore. Even then, they're doing their own songs. They're doing modern theater songs, which kind of has an interest to me. But what can I tell you?
Well, I mean, at this point, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, James Tapping, those are standards now, quote unquote.
They are standards. I kind of checked out. How do I say this? December 31st, 1979, meaning the songs of the 70s, that singer-songwriter era that I was a young man in, and those are the things you remember. I love those, and I sing some of those. As a matter of fact, I'm preparing a show from songs from the 70s. They were beautiful ballads.
Well, like what? I'm curious what songs you would have included in that.
I have already recorded one, two, but I will expand upon that. I think, what do you think of this as the name of an album? Time in a Bottle.
Oh, there you go. So Jim Croce. I get it. That's it. That's actually really good.
I like the idea.
However, I will say that I have a CD of my own called Time in a Bottle of Manischewitz.
Did that sell for you?
No, not at all.
Oh, I know.
I've got 400 of them in my closet. It's...
No, my CDs are under my bed. I mean, I try to give them away, but sometimes I get mournful looks saying, well, you know, I really don't have a CD player anymore. I never thought I'd heard that. All right, I'm 78 years old. Here's what happened. Years ago, I used to know a marvelous guy who was... I approached him. I said, Al, it's your birthday soon. He said, yes, I'm soon to be an old 78, and we had a laugh about that. So, but this particular joke does not work at all anymore. Nobody remembers what a 78 is, but there's an LP or whatever. I'm not trying to be a stick in the mud. I'm just saying that you have to be flexible and go with the times. You don't have to join up with them, but you have to be aware of what's going on, especially if you're a professional musician like myself.
But the thing is, you said you stopped in 79, that you haven't really paid attention to the music of the 80s through the aughts plus.
I'm embarrassed to tell you that that is an accurate assessment.
Okay.
I don't know from the 80s. I don't know from the 90s. My nephew stays with me, who's 45, but he's a very checked out guy. He was in a rock and roll band, and any time I ask who this person is, if I haven't been able to find him or her on the miraculous YouTube, he says, oh yeah, they were big and here was the hit. And I just, what can I tell you? I don't have much time left. I cannot examine any of that stuff now.
You sound and seem pretty healthy. Are you?
I am very healthy. My voice is in better shape than it ever was. My fingers work great. I just did a concert last night sometimes I get really a specialized project that intrigues me. There is a wonderful art gallery here in Manhattan called the Neue Gallery of Viennese Art. Mm. And you may know there was a movie made about a famous Klimt painting called The Woman in the Gold Dress.
I think Scarlett Johansson was in that.
The most expensive paintings ever made. Anyway, yeah. They have a beautiful little cabaret there, and they feature people singing German and Austrian songs. And so I put up a program of the Jewish emigres in 1933 who left, had to force to leave Berlin and Austria, and Friedrich Hollander, who wrote for Marlene Dietrich, Kurt Weill, of course, the most famous of all, and another one named Spolyansky, who went to London. And I love singing in other languages. I sing in Portuguese, I sing in French, I sing in German. I've always been fascinated by linguistics and all of that thing. So sometimes a specialized idea will come along that really catches my fancy. Now, what if somebody were to say, look, I'm going to pay you, $1 million to learn a program of hits from the 80s.
Yes, I do.
I'd learn it, but I don't know where I'd begin. I'd have to hire a cadre of 10-year-olds, I suppose.
But I'll bet you would find 12 to 14 or 15, 20 songs that you could connect with and that would not necessarily be old-style like Porter and Coward and Lesser and Lerner and Lowe, but would still, you'd be like, oh, I can turn that into a cabaret kind of song.
But I did with Time in a Bottle. I changed the feeling of it. As a matter of fact, I didn't realize that Dave only had one of my albums, so I'm going to send him, and maybe he can share some with you. I'm going to send him a bunch of my CDs, and on it you will hear this. Yeah, and I did a new version of, for example, Eleanor Rigby, that I thought was very powerful. Because the Beatles had words and tunes. They had tunes. They had tunes, man. That's what I need. I need tunes. I don't need things that repeat or that are riffs. But listen, Katy Perry, who was a pop star, one of the biggest, almost filled Madison Square Garden the other day, so what do I know?
Well, I mean, but also, as you said, you have to grow and evolve. There's a well-known guitarist, songwriter named Richard Thompson. I don't know if you've ever heard.
Don't know of him, no.
No, no. I mean, he's a brilliant, from the 70s, literally, or on, till now. Still a brilliant composer, songwriter, etc. But he did this CD of 1,000 Years of American Popular Music. And he did them all in his style. And it was everything from madrigals, the medieval era.
The CD with selections from all of these years?
Well, he did one CD, and he would do a song, as I said, like a 1,000-year-old madrigal, and then there'd be a Britney Spears song. And it was, if it was a good song, if it was a nice tune, it didn't matter when it was from or who wrote it, or if it was kitschy, or if it was, you know, people would look down on it because it wasn't written by, Hart or something like that. It's a thing, you know, you should investigate Tom Waits. You could probably do some good Tom Waits numbers.
But he was from the 70s, though, wasn't he?
Well, he still is. I mean, he started.
Now, I'm very keen about, to write that. So this chap's name is Richard Thompson?
Yeah, I don't know if it would be to your taste, but Richard Thompson is a brilliant... Yeah. Check him out, Richard Thompson.
I could find him on YouTube. Maybe I could find his CD. I'm very interested in that.
Oh, good.
He's done a lot of work that I've been too lazy to do. You mean he has picked the best of so many genres, and I really respect that. So I'm going to dig him out.
I'm so glad I clued you in with that. Oh, boy, I've actually helped Steve Ross widen his music appreciation, just as he's done to me over these years with what he's done with people like Rodgers and Hammerstein and Cole Porter. And you have worked with or played for and with some legendary nightclub artists.
I have indeed. I've been very, very lucky that when I came along, that many of these great ladies and gents were still around and performing, and I accompanied them, and I learned from them. I began learning from the grand dame of all of us, Mabel Mercer, of whom you know.
Right.
Or do you? Do you know?
Well, she was a little before my time, but of course I've heard of her.
She was the great cabaret singer, and just told the stories and enchanted everybody. And the reason I moved to New York was somebody threw a record of Bobby Short.
Ah, yes.
This was the acme of sophistication and style.
And of course you ended up playing at the Algonquin.
I played at the Algonquin, and I went to hear all of these people who were around when I got here in the 70s. And the relics from in the 60s had changed everything and everything, but some of the great people were still playing, and I played in a theatrical piano bar called Backstage, and many of them came along and sang, so I got a chance to play for Liza and Chita Rivera and Rita Moreno, and they would just get up and sing.
Do you have any anecdotes? Do you have any memories of them or Barbara Cook or Julie Wilson? Some funny thing that happened or something they taught you? Something poignant?
Well, I wish I had a raft of those memories because it would make this interview interesting. But I will say this, of the late lamented, and boy, what a fantastic communicating singer Barbara Cook was. A unique talent, a gorgeous voice. I did a summer tour with her in 1974, and she was just coming out of a dark period in her life. But I'd always loved her voice. I knew her from Music Man, and it was thrilling just to go to these little theaters, and she was in the cast. Harold Lang was in the cast. Julie Wilson, Nancy Dussault. At any rate, I just remember that Barbara, when she was I remember in a car when she was demonstrating a song. She said, "Steve, you remember that song that goes, 'Embrace me, my sweet'?" Even when she was demonstrating a song, it meant so much to her that she had to perform the song. Mm-hmm. Whereas I might just say, "Oh, I know that song, 'Embrace me, my sweet'." What I'm trying to say is that songs were so important for her that she couldn't even slight them when she was quoting them in conversation. And I said, boy, this is something very important, that music is to her essence born. And I'll never forget that.
That is actually lovely. That's that's how I say prayers. I can't just say Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu. No, I just got Baruch Atah Adonai. I gotta do it all the way full.
It's an analogous story that she always sang, even not loud, but she always sang. I'm not saying that it's good or bad. I'm just saying I was impressed that that was how she.
Oh yeah, no, I'm just relating it to me because God hasn't done anything for me, no matter how I sing the prayers. But I'm hoping. I hope to sing loud enough that he hears at some point. It'd be nice.
So listen, he brought us together. I think that's a nice mitzvah.
You use the lingo, baby. There's got to be some Jew in you
somewhere. I'm a New Yorker. I'm Jewish. That's, come on.
There you go. Hey, is it true that sometimes at the piano when you're performing, you wear Noel Coward's actual jacket?
Yes, of course it is. Yeah, I wear it.
Well, how'd you get Noel Coward's jacket?
It was given to me by the Noel Coward Society. One of the gentlemen had acquired it, and it was tailor-made for Coward, and I wear it, and I'm very honored to wear it, I must say. It's a beautiful coat. Yeah, I like it.
Do you have any of his underwear or just the jacket?
Don't have any of his personal effects, no. I don't. No, I have, what do I have? No, I don't have anything else by anybody that's famous except Noah Coward's jacket, in fact.
I mean, if you had, like, one of his spare socks, I could use it.
That would be interesting, that I could wear and never change. No, I don't, actually. No handkerchiefs, no socks, no...
But here's the deal. It's Noah Coward's jacket, right? So you didn't have to... It kind of fits you. You have the same build. You didn't have to take it in or do anything, right?
Yeah, no, it just fit. I just stepped into this coat, and it fits me perfectly, and I perform in it, and it's a handsome coat. At any rate,
but do you launder it, or do you, are you? No, I would never.
Sometimes I have a dry cleaner.
Oh, you do. Okay.
A durable, bespoke item from London. But at the end of my show, I stand up and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, you may have been admiring my beautiful green velvet coat," and I describe how I received it, and then I say, at the end of the show, economically, I said, if you wish to embrace me at the conclusion of my performance, and that is encouraged, think of it, you get two for the price of one, and I get a laugh, and I often get a kiss.
Oh, there you go. Very nice.
Very nice.
Speaking of kissing, and not to get too personal, but your private life, are you in a relationship, marriage thing ever? What?
Oh, no, I've traveled the way single O, never thought that it would be, it's hard. Ellington's famous autobiography, Music Is My Mistress, music, it takes up a lot of time, and I'm much more of a person who looks at all of my wonderful, wonderful friends around the world as my aggregate lover. And it's wonderful because I'm never bored. They want another person. I've never been one that has had any success in being one of two people. I'm one of a lot of people.
So. Is it because you are so devoted to music, or you're just a pain in the ass to be with?
I mean, maybe I'm high maintenance. I travel a lot. I take everything too I know there are parts of my character that are not built for the flexibility that's required to have a long-term relationship. That's all. Simple as that. It's not going to be happening now.
What do you mean, not now? People in their 70s, go to nursing homes. Everybody's hooking up.
Well, I suppose I play for those people at nursing homes. That's one of the things that I do. Maybe my songs encourage a little spark of love. I have no idea. I'm not so aware of that so much. But I know that that's not me. I mean, I have a wonderful mishpucha here. I have my wonderful nephew. I have a roommate who is a dancer, and we have a very tight... We have our own family. We rarely see each other outside of the house.
Best kind of family, yes.
We're loving, and we're always there for each other, and I feel very confident in that, and I'm very blessed.
By the way, Steve Ross, since you started as a piano player before you really were told that you ought to sing and you could sing and you had to sing and stuff, but in that period, or even now, all these songs that you sing by other people. Did you ever try your hand at writing your own?
I have. On one of the albums that I'm sending to Dave, which he will share with you, I did write a song I'm quite proud of. I remember I was in a pianist in a show that Sammy Kahn wrote once with Julie Stein years ago. And he's a brilliant songwriter, of course. And I talked about this idea of songwriting because I had written this melody. And he said, "Well, you know, I'm a word guy. I wake up." He was always writing songs in his head. Julie Stein, these composers and lyricists who do this, their minds are whirling around in those fields. I don't wake up wanting to write a song. Every now and then, a lyric is presented to me, or I work with somebody. So I have about five songs that I've written that I think are nice, but the world doesn't need another mediocre ballad, so I have to make it special. But one of the songs that I will be sending to Dave is from an album I did called My Manhattan. A lot of songs about New York, of which there are hundreds, and a friend of mine wrote a song called Manhattan Moon that I think is very sweet. So you'll hear that, but I should do another recording, all of my own songs, but what does that mean, a recording? I don't know. It's not going to be issued on CD. It'll be a digital recording, but maybe that's what it has to be.
That's the way it is now. I mean, if it's the way it is, and the nice thing is, if you have six songs and you don't want to add any more, you call it an EP or something. You don't have to do to fill a CD with 60 or 70 minutes. It's whatever you want now.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me for that. You're right. It can be a mini thing, and I could do that. I could do that because why not? And I have a couple of ideas for another album. I've accompanied a lot of wonderful people, and I have recordings. So it'd be Steve Ross. Everybody in the world did a duet album, right? I mean,
there you go. That's right. You could. Do,
I could put that in something like that.
Find a good ocarina player. You never know. It could be a
good ocarina player.
Yeah.
I could call it, but you won't get this because it's a pre-Vatican Council Catholic reference. I could call it Alone and With Others. When you were a little child and you went to confession, you are familiar with that process.
Kind of, yes.
Confess our little sins to the priest. And it was made worse if you did whatever this little thing you did when you involved other people. So that the question that was posed to the great was, now, was this alone or with others? So I think alone and with others. And maybe the three Roman Catholics that I know will get it a lap, but other than that, it's going to be my songs and my duets.
Three Roman Catholics and Harvey Weinstein would get it, pretty much.
Weinstein might get it, yes.
He just might.
That's
just
true. Unfortunately, isn't that a blot upon the world? Anyway.
With others, for sure. By the way, we are with the wonderful, delightful Steve Ross, whom you can see on October 23rd doing Come On and Here. By the way, October 23rd, it's this Monday. I might as well tell you that. Is it an 8 o'clock show, 7:30? Do you know what time it starts?
7 o'clock show.
Ooh. Nice and early.
A joint that's usually for jazz, but on Monday they devoted to Broadway and cabaret performers.
So do you stick around Monday nights for, was it Jim Caruso's cast party?
You know about that. Oh, yeah, that's been going for so many years. It's a mixed bag. I mean, sometimes you get great people along and sometimes you don't. But, I often... I have performed there, yeah.
Because it's Monday night, so I figure after your show, on comes Jim Caruso, and then he does his thing. So.
Yes, he does, and he's a wonderful, charming performer, and has one of the best pianists in town as his partner, Billy Stritch. Think about the music that is available, the music that I love, tomorrow night I'm taking a date to hear two of the finest pianists who are alive.
Who?
Joint show. One of them is Bill Charlap.
Okay. Related to Moose?
Was his mentor. What's his name? Oh, my God. I'm just blocking. It's terrible.
I've heard of a Moose Charlap.
No. That's his son.
Oh. Okay.
Moose Charlap was a songwriter who, a Broadway composer, who was married to a still divine song, a singer named Sandy Stewart.
Okay.
They produced this fantastic... recorded many, many years ago by one of the great pianists alive named Dick Hyman.
Oh, okay, yes.
And he...
Boy, did he take some crap growing up
with
that name, but anyway, yes.
So, I performed often at the Y, 96th Street Y, and they have so many, well, it being, of course, a Jewish educational thrust.
Of course.
Concerts, and they have everything you can go to, and it's a great resource for me.
Well, you have been a delightful and a marvelous resource for us, both on this program and in your style, your elegance, your music, and now, no, I didn't even know about your humor, and so what a wonderful laugh you have. I wish I could make you laugh again, just to...
You just did.
We did it. Wonderful.
I know, but you're so wonderful. I'm sorry you don't live nearby. We could schmooze and go out for coffee every minute, but you live out there, and I live here, so...
I know. It would be a delight to schmooze with Stephen Ben Clifford here in his neck of the neighborhood. So, Steve, all I can wish you is... Thank God, continued good health. One more question. Because so much of what you do, or to get paid to do, is in foreign countries, does the travel ever wear on you? Because you have to go here. I mean, it's one thing to drive somewhere or take a subway. Quite another, oh, yeah, I'm in Germany again. Oh, now I'm in England.
No, it doesn't seem to bother me. I'm lucky to get a job in England just about every year. I used to work in Brazil. I worked in Australia. I did a tour there a couple of years. Somehow, I don't know, I'm a Sagittarian. It doesn't seem to bother me too much as long as I can take naps and have a few chemicals or something. It's fine. It doesn't seem to bother me too much. I'm lucky about that. And I've been going, well, not going this year, but I've been going to Sri Lanka.
Ooh.
Here. That's a fur piece. But anyway, so the answer to your question is I'm lucky. It doesn't seem to bother me. And not having, you know, commitments here, no pets, no wives, no boyfriends, whatever, I can close the door and take my suitcase and go and do my stuff, which is great.
Well, it certainly is great, and it's been great having Steve Ross with us in the neighborhood. Steve, health, music, luck to you, and joy.
And the same to you, my friend.
Shalom.
Shalom. Bye-bye.